I've been preparing this message for 15 years, and I might have shared parts of it before, but never as thoroughly as I want to do here. I have a few objects today that I want to talk about. I want to make some specific applications towards the end of this, but right now my main concern is to define and diagnose syncretism and talk about it and what is all involved in this discussion. I think I can use this here. Yeah, hey, look at that. So what is syncretism? This funny word. It's easy to think of. Just think of syncing things up. Like you sync your computer and your phone or syncing. It's just syncing things up. So things that weren't together, you're putting together ideas that don't originally belong with each other. The combining of different beliefs while blending practices of various schools of thought. Syncretism involves the merging or assimilation of several originally discrete traditions, especially in the theology and mythology of religion, thus asserting an underlying unity and allowing for inclusive approach to other faiths. What does that mean? Let's look at some examples of what syncretism is. This is syncretism. I was in Israel, and when I was there, Erica was able to come with me, and I had some friends who were originally from Alabama, and I brought them back a tile that said exactly that. This isn't my tile, but this is mixing Southern American vernacular with shalom from Hebrew. Who knows where these are from? The Sistine Chapel. It's a beautiful work of art. I'd love to see it someday. I've read about it. I've studied about it. You know, this is a very, 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 very famous piece of art from one of the panels from the Sistine Chapel. But what are these? Does anybody recognize these? So in the Sistine Chapel, there's all these panels across the top of the ceiling. And where the panels come together, there's cornices. And in these cornices, Michelangelo put the 12 prophets. So these are a few of the 12 prophets. I think this one's Jonah for sure. This is a famous piece of art because the cornice comes like this, but he's rearing back. It's a famous in perspective. I think this is Ezekiel. I'm not sure who these others are, but the 12 prophets are all in there. But also in there, let's go back, are these. Does anybody recognize who these are? These are the oracles. The oracles are not Hebrew prophets, they're Greek pagan prophets. This is an example of religious syncretism. Michelangelo, in painting this very famous church in the Vatican, includes in his religious motifs the oracles. Now, this one's Delphi, the Delphic Oracle, and there's four of them. And they're right along with the prophets in the Sistine Chapel. So you have the 12 Hebrew prophets and the four oracles. And this, all throughout religious art, you'll see many, many instances in the Renaissance and in other places where pagan themes and motifs and figures will enter into Christian religious art. This is an example of syncretism in art. This is another example of syncretism in art. This is nationalist syncretism. Here you have Jesus over the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Here you have Jesus holding the Constitution with the White House in the background and all these famous American figures, and everybody's honoring both Jesus and the Constitution. This is nationalism as syncretism. We all know this is bad, right? This is really bad. This is not a good thing. Because why, right? Just think of what syncretism does. When you incorporate the Constitution and you put it with Jesus, now you're making the Constitution divine, right? You're putting a divine sanction on something that doesn't come from God's mouth. It's a big problem. Here's the same thing. This is not a divine. God didn't do this. Men did this. God may have allowed it, but God didn't do it. It's not from him. I want to look at a few passages, and I want to do this fairly quickly. So we're going to kind of blaze through these, if you will, with me. So get your fingers wet and ready to flip pages, and let's look at a few of these examples of syncretism in the Old Testament prophets. Let's start with 2 Chronicles. I'll try to paraphrase, but we'll read enough that we can get the story. 2 Chronicles, chapter 33. this is the story of Manasseh. He's 12 years old. He does all this stuff. And then in verse 3, notice, "For he built again the high places which Hezekiah his father had broken down, and reared up altars for Balaam, and made groves, and worshipped all the hosts of heaven and served them. Also he built altars in the house of the Lord, whereof the Lord had said, 'In Jerusalem shall my name be forever.' And he built altars for all the hosts of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord." So it's kind of syncretic in that he's building these things in Israel and he's building them in the temple. But this isn't like purely syncretic. This is just idolatry. He's just changed religions. But what happens is that God curses him. The people fall, I think, to the Assyrians. And then he repents. And when he comes back, it says here, in verse 11, "Wherefore the Lord brought upon them the captains of the hosts of the king of Assyria, which took Manasseh among the thorns and bound him with fetters and carried him to Babylon. And when he was in affliction, he besought the Lord his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers." Verse 13, "And prayed unto him, and he was entreated of him and heard his supplication and brought him again to Jerusalem into his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord, he was God." Okay, so there's a conversion. That's great. Wonderful. Verse 14, "Now after this, he built a wall," and he sets people on the wall. Verse 15, "And he took away the strange gods and the idol out of the house of the Lord, and all the altars that he had built in the mount of the house of the Lord, and in Jerusalem, and cast them out of the city. And he repaired the altar of the Lord, and sacrificed thereon peace offerings and thank offerings, and commanded Judah to serve the Lord God of Israel. Nevertheless, the people did sacrifice still in the high places, yet unto the Lord their God only." So this, at the end of the chapter, is a pure version of syncretism. They have taken the groves and the altars that Manasseh set up in his youth to worship false gods. He goes into captivity. He repents. He comes back. He purges the temple. But the people like this new custom. And so they take a syncretic approach and say, "We will continue to worship God, God alone, because we've converted, we're back on the right track, but we're going to do it in the groves in the high places." This is not good. Let's look at another example. Deuteronomy chapter 7. "When the Lord thy God shall bring thee into the land whither thou goest to possess it, and have cast out many nations before thee, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than thou. And when the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them, neither shalt thou make marriages..." Skip down to 4, "For they will turn away thy sons from following me, that they may serve other gods, so will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy thee suddenly." Verse 5, "But thus shall ye deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their images, and cut down their groves, and burn their graven images with fire." It's a scorched earth policy to the idolatry of the promised land. God is telling them, "I want no space for these practices among my people in the promised land. Cut it down, burn it to ash, get rid of it, don't leave any of it around. I want nothing to do with these practices of these people that I'm driving out before you." That's what he's saying. Deuteronomy chapter 12, flip over a couple chapters. In the end of this chapter, in verse 29, "When the Lord thy God shall cut off the nations from before thee, whither thou goest to possess them, and thou succeedest them, and dwellest in their land, take heed to thyself, that thou be not snared by following them, after that they be destroyed from before thee, and that thou inquire not after their gods, saying, 'How did these nations serve their gods? Even so will I do likewise.'" So now we're not even talking about just the things in and of themselves. We dealt with that in chapter 7. God says, burn it to the ground, cut it down, get rid of it, make no space for it. But now he's saying to them in a more personal way, don't try to figure out the way that they're worshiping their gods and say, I'm going to treat Jehovah that way. This is a specific command. I don't want you to take those practices from those people that are driven out from before you and inquire. Don't look after them. Don't try to figure out why they're doing what they're doing and if you can do the same thing to me, because you can't. That's what he says. Let's look at Exodus 32. You guys with me? Exodus 32, verse 4. This is when Moses goes up to Sinai. He's up there for a long time. Everybody gets restless. And they come to Aaron and say, we don't know what's going on with Moses. We gotta start over. Verse 3, all the people break off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them unto Aaron. And he received them at their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool after he had made it a molten calf. And they said, these be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And that's always, since I was a little kid, that's the part that's bothered me about this. Is that it's one thing when Manasseh just switches religion, right? That's bad. And that there's lots of examples of that, especially in the bad kings, of people who just like, hey, I'm done with this Jehovah nonsense. We're going to go follow other gods. Happens in some of the other prophetic literature. And there are warnings specifically about idolatry, just of switching sides and going after other gods. But there's also this notion that Aaron is representing these calves as the gods that they know. So Moses has been representing God to these people, and Aaron says, these are that. And this is a greater sin in my mind. From my perspective, it would be one thing to go after another god, but to make Jehovah the only god in the representation of these other things, to blaspheme on top of your idolatry, to say that this is that, is a great sin among the people. I'm going to just mention Ezekiel chapter 8. Let's go there. We'll look at it. Ezekiel 8, this whole chapter is fascinating. You know, this is the passage where he has this vision. He's taken up by the hair, and he sees in the temple, and there's all these idolatries. You know, he digs through the wall, and he sees the elders with incense censers, and the smoke has filled the room, and there's every creeping thing that they're worshiping around painted on the walls inside the temple. It's temple idolatry, which is particularly horrible. But in verse 15, he says this. I think the context of all this being in the temple is an important part of this. Where am I? 8:15. Then said he unto me, this is after several visions, hast thou seen this, O son of man? Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations than these. This is kind of like the culmination of abominations. And he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs towards the temple of the Lord, and their faces towards the east, and they worshiped the sun toward the east. They're in God's temple, and they're turning their back away from what God told them to do, and worshiping the sun. Then he said unto me, hast thou seen this, O son of man? Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence and have returned to provoke me to anger. And lo, they put the branch to their nose. Therefore will I also deal in fury. Mine eye shall not spare, neither will I have pity. And though they cry in mine ears with a loud voice, yet will I not hear them. It's intense stuff. Jeremiah chapter 10. Kind of a famous passage when we talk about syncretism. He describes these idols, but I'm most interested in these first few verses. Hear ye the word of the Lord. Hear ye the word which the Lord speaketh unto you, O house of Israel. Thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen. Just like that passage that we read before. I don't want you to learn their ways. I do not want you to look to them as an example. Learn not the way of the heathen, and be not dismayed at the signs of the heavens, for the heathen are dismayed at them. For the customs of the people are vain. And he goes on to describe them, but we'll stop there. The customs of these people are vain. What they're doing, the way that they worship their gods, is a vanity. It's false. That's what he's saying. Let's flip back to Leviticus. I should have put those in better order for you. Leviticus 18, verse 3. Lord spake to Moses in verse 1 and verse 3, after the doings of the land of Egypt wherein ye dwelt, shall ye not do. And after the doings of the land of Canaan, whither I bring you, shall ye not do. Neither shall you walk in their ordinances. You shall do my judgments and keep mine ordinances to walk therein. I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man do, he shall also live in them. I am the Lord. And he goes on with more Levitical provisions. We could also have looked at how specific God was in the ordinances that he gave in the temple. And that's a particularly compelling example. I probably should have put it up here. But you know, if you read through those passages, they get kind of dry. Put this many of this kind of skin and use this many rings of this kind of gold and this staff and this wood and this covering and this skin and this color and on and on and on and on. Those very, very specific blueprints for the tabernacle laid out from God to Moses. And he says, keep this the way I told you. I told you specifically because I want you to do it specifically. Now, the reason that's a particularly compelling example to me is that our apostle, assuming Paul wrote Hebrews, our apostle writes these things in Hebrews as an example that he's learning what God intended. He said, I wish I had time to go on to all these things that are written in how the temple was put together, how the tabernacle came together. He sees in those things that God provided, which look like minutia of detail to us, he sees God's plan in order. And we can look back at the Old Testament and we can see in these provisions of God, in his specificity and in his statutes and ordinances, what he's trying to communicate. There's something in all the details. And that's compelling. 1 John 5 and in 1 Corinthians 10, we don't even need to look there. Those are keep yourselves from idols. And that's a compelling, interesting passage to me too. I don't know how many times you've thought it, but I've thought it a lot of times in my life. I'm a 21st century Western Christian. Why does the Bible tell me to watch for idols? Why is it telling me? Why is it telling you? Why do the apostles? I get it, okay, in their day, in the Greco-Roman world, idols are in the town center, and they're all over the place. They're in people's homes. They're all over the place. But what does it mean for me and you to be told, above all, keep yourselves from idols? Where are they? Who are the idols in our lives? What are the idols in our lives? Where are the syncretism that we live in? And how do we tell the difference between shalom, y'all, and erecting altars and groves in high places? Let's look into it. Hosea, I thought a lot about him this last week. I don't know if you have places in the Bible that are hard for you to read, but I have to confess, sometimes I'll avoid Hosea because he's so tragic. Like, it's just a really bummer of a story. And there's important things there. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying I got to be in a mood for Hosea because it's such a heavy book to read. I mean, it starts off when he says, I want you to go out and marry a prostitute, and she's going to betray you. And then he plays out this horror story of a life with this prostitute that God told him to marry. And sometimes it's a little much for me, and I'm just like, you know, I don't have that in me today. I'm going to read something else. But the main tragedy of Hosea, like it's like, you can read Job, right? And Job is tragic. And there's all these horrible things that happen in Job's life. And you see people, and I know people, and sometimes in our own personal lives, we experience these deep tragedies, these terrible losses, these horrible pains, and we identify with Job. And that's good, and I can read Job that way. But the difference is, when I read Hosea, he's not talking about a man. God does this to Hosea because he wants to create a picture for you and for me and for all of his people to understand, this is how I, your God, feel about you, my people. It's not just the story of human tragedy. It's the story of divine tragedy. It's a story of a God who is so faithful and so merciful and so loving to his people who just keep turning their back on him. And it's horrible. It just makes you want to cry. Poor Hosea. I can't wait to see his exaltation and glory for his faithfulness in that example for us. But all the prophets, this is their main job. They're all doing the same thing. Their job, their purpose, their mission, no matter what walk of life they were coming from, no matter how they did it, no matter what they said, they all have the same job. And that job of the prophets is to keep, it's to keep God's people in covenant. And that's a cheesy way to say it. What the prophet does is he understands well what God's intention and purpose is. He can see God's purposes. And this is an important and he can evaluate how far away God's people are from that purpose and try to pull them together. This is the prophetic. And this is why these stories that we've been looking at, these lessons, these instructions, these rebukes, these all this history of the Old Testament is for our profit and for our learning because the prophets did a good job. They pointed out the places in their time and for all time, the pitfalls that God's people walk into in walking away from him and failing for his purpose and vision for what he wants for them. Why did this happen? I'll tell you a story. I've told it before. I went to the science museum quite a few years ago. Elijah was young. He and I went together, and I was particularly interested to go to the science museum because there was a rotating exhibit. We planned this trip specifically for this traveling exhibit of the Dead Sea Scrolls. They had some of the Dead Sea Scrolls texts that they brought down here to Boston, the Boston Science Museum. And I was very eager to see them. I was happy especially to see some of the apocryphal texts that were included in those because, like, one of those texts that was in that exhibit was from Tobit, which recalibrated all of scholarship to put Tobit back before the Christian era. Before then, it was only considered a post-Christian Jewish text, and so it recalibrates all these really, really, really significant texts. And that's why I went there. It was the main point was to go see the Dead Sea Scrolls. But they had an exhibit in a side room before you got to the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I walked into this room, and I wasn't expecting, I didn't know what it was there, and they had this whole wall full of all these little curio shelves, like about, I'd say about 4 inches square, hundreds of them. Let's say dozens. I don't know how big the wall was. Dozens of them. And it caught me off guard, like, what are those? And I went over and looked at them, and I realized very soon, even before I read the inscription, these were household gods that were dug up in Israel. So when you read the prophets talking about these these idols who, having ears they hear not and having eyes they see not, these prophetic rebukes to the people of Israel about these false gods, like, I'm looking at them right here, right now, from the Second Bronze Era. I'm looking at the idols that the people of Israel sold out Jehovah for these stupid little terracotta idols. Why'd they do that? It doesn't make sense to me. I know the stories that those Hebrews knew. And they were much closer to him. I know about Moses parting the Red Sea. They knew about Moses parting the Red Sea. I knew about the Passover. They knew about the Passover. In light of all that, why do so many Hebrews forsake Jehovah for these dumb little terracotta idols? I can't answer that explicitly, but I've thought about it a lot. How does that happen? How do you, as a Jew, growing up in Israel, with news of the prophets, commemorating the stories, seeing the landmarks, give up your faith for these dumb idols? I've thought a lot of times how that would happen. And again, this is my speculation. Don't have to put anything more in it than that. But I just imagine I'm in my Jewish village, and we didn't purge all the Canaanites out of the land. We didn't purge all the Perizzites out of the land. We didn't purge all these people. They stayed. The Jebusites stayed. And true to God's word, they became a thorn in the eye of his people. And so you have a neighbor, a Canaanite neighbor, and his crops did really well last year, and your crops did really poorly this year. And you're talking to Joe, your neighbor, and you say, "Hey, what'd you do different than I did? How come your crops grow so much better than mine? How come you're doing so much better?" "Oh, well, I have an idol out back. And we make sacrifices to it, and it's a god of the harvest, and he makes things work for us. We do for him, he does for us." And I think, "Well, I can't do that. I'm not going to worship that god." But maybe I could do that. I could make a little altar in the back of my field, because my God's powerful. He cares about me like his God cares about him. I just need to make an altar out in the back of my field. And I'll offer to Jehovah. I don't want to be sacrilegious. I'm not an idolater. But I'll do the same thing. I'll just do it to Jehovah. 1,000 different versions of that kind of story. Somebody's sick, your child's sick. Somebody's going to die. Fell on misfortune. And the desire that is always provoked by idolatry is something tangible. Go all the way back to the calf in Sinai. At the giving of the law, they say, "We don't want to deal with him, you deal with it." And then they end up being distanced. They don't have the experience that Moses has. He brings the tablets down, and they're not happy with it. Over and over again, we want a king like the nations around us. We want gods like the nations around us. We want experiences like the nations around us. Why are we always so different? Why do we have to have our own way for everything? It doesn't work for us sometimes. Maybe we should do like the other people around us. I want something tangible. I want something I can put my hands on. I want something I can see. I want something I can see. And this is the appeal of idolatry. Because God calls his people to faith and to trust. And they over and over again turn to these idols, or they turn to the chariots of Egypt, or they turn to political alliances, or they turn to help from some other place, and they don't have eyes of faith. That's the appeal of idolatry. Make it real. Make it tangible. That's the first step, I think, in these departures into idolatry, is the desire for something tangible, the desire to be like the nations. You know, we mentioned the groves and the high place, especially with Manasseh's story. How many times does it happen that the final inventory of one of the leaders of Israel, one of the kings, is tabulated, and it says something like, "He was a good king and he did right before the Lord, but he did not remove the groves of the high places." It's this constant nagging failure again and again. Okay, you can worship God, but we're going to do it in the groves. We're going to do it in the high places. It's persistent. Jeroboam, Ahab, Jezebel, Manasseh, Solomon. Solomon's at a high place when he has his vision and asks God for wisdom. That's at a high place. God's even meeting people there in his mercy. He's winking at their ignorance. But that's a high place. At Gibeah, I think. Asa and Jehoshaphat were both reformers, and they reformed up to that point, but didn't remove the high places in the groves. Ahaz, Joram, and the people. It says over again, the people. The people wanted these things. They wanted the high places, and they wanted the groves. Hezekiah and Josiah are particularly notable because they're two of the only that I know that were notable for removing them. Only two in that history, unless I'm counting wrong. Okay. Here's an important issue I want to lay out here while we're talking about this. I tend to make caricatures out of these Bible stories. The prophet is kind of this shrouded, dark, smoky figure of righteousness, almost like faceless, almost like an angel, right? Like some brooding, dark figure. The Pharisees are these, you know, shriveled up monsters with long fingernails and fangs. Like they're just caricatures of evil that hate Jesus and are out to get him. We make these caricatures. Maybe it's because we grow up with these stories as children and we think of them in terms of children's stories and fairy tales. I don't know what it's from, but the thing to do for us to learn from the scriptures is to take these things out of caricature and put them into some real tangibility. Make them real. Make the Pharisees, learn the Pharisees for who they really are. They're the faithful ones through the Maccabean era, the ones that won't bow to Hellenism. They're the good guys in the story before Jesus comes on the scene. That's why they're the religious leaders. Not because they were devils, but because they were the righteous ones when everybody else was falling away. Why is everybody named Judas? Because Judas Maccabee was a hero in Israel that stood up against Hellenization and the idolatry that was being crammed down their throats. That's who the Pharisees were. That's the forefathers of the Pharisees. They were the faithful. And so it's a scandal for Jesus to say your righteousness must exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Not because they're fang-toothed monsters, but because they're well-respected and known to be the holy people in the land of Israel. The faithful ones, the ones that are serious about God. And if you don't connect those dots, you're not getting the point out of the stories that we have in the New Testament about who those people are and why they opposed Jesus. With all of that history, he presents a challenge to what they think it's supposed to be. That's the lesson. And you and I are subject to that problem. I'm not subject to being a fang-toothed monster that hates Jesus. I am subject to being a person who's pursuing righteousness so much that I could miss what Jesus is trying to say to me. That's a real risk. And idolaters are in the same category. We always put them in this term, and we think if I don't have a little shelf somewhere in the back of my house with one of these terracotta icons and some candles and a bowl of fruit that I've laid out for it, that I'm not an idolater. But that's a caricature. There's something else for us to learn. We're taught these lessons because God wants us to learn from them. And it's important for us when we consider these things, when we consider these stories, when we focus in the church on these particular lessons, that we're asking ourselves, how does this apply to me? What are some of our idols and our groves and high places? That's the question before us today. I want to take a case in point, and I want to look at a particular example of syncretism that does apply to you and me. And it's the example of the Christ Mass. I think that there's a valid prophetic indictment of this particular holiday. Let me just start by saying, we've never had a Christmas service at Followers of the Way, and I hope we never will. I know that different of us have different ways that we interact with this time of year and this season and these holidays. We have different ways that we interact with our family about these things, and we have maybe some different feelings about how serious of an issue it is, and so I want to take a look at it. I've thought about doing this message the last 2 years, and every time I didn't get to it, and our citywide last year, I think, fell on December 24th, and it felt just way too on the nose, and probably half of us were gone having Christmas with our families, and so it didn't make sense to do it then. So I'm trying to get ahead of the season this year and talk about these things while it's still relevant. Here's the indictment of the Christ Mass. The timing conforms with syncretic purposes. It's a syncretic reason that this celebration happens on December 25th. I'll talk about that more. The customs of what this holiday does and is come primarily from pagan practices. The current incarnation of these things is full of worldliness and fueled by consumerism and secularism, and the celebration of the Christ Mass misdirects us from God's intentions. It's a misdirection. It points us away from what I think God wants us to look at. So let's examine these a little bit closer. And let me say here, I'm going to do a couple more parts of these, but I'm not going to subject you all in a citywide to them. What I'm going to do is I'm either going to do a Loom or another YouTube series on, because the reason this has been 10 or 15 years in the making is because I really geek out on the connections between, I really geek out on the connections between pagan practices and these later Christian syncretic practices. It's a fascinating history, and it's really complex, and it's multi-tiered, and it's multifaceted. The way I think of it is this: you know, if you look at English as a language, it's an incredibly robust language. It happens to be durable in ways that a lot of other languages haven't been. And part of the reason for the durability of the English language is that it kind of has this judo characteristic. Whenever an invading force comes towards English in history, it just kind of rolls with it and makes that invading language a part of itself. It doesn't break, it bends. And there's something about what has happened with syncretism in the West, especially fueled by the Roman Catholic Church and its colonialism throughout the ages, is that Christmas has become like that. It's one of these holidays that just wherever it runs into a foreign pagan people, it just takes it and makes it a part of it and keeps going. And so there's a lot of threads. And I want to go into more details about this in these future messages, because a lot of the material that you'll read in defense of Christmas or against Christmas is really propaganda-ish. It's not dealing with firsthand information or even trying to. It's making some wild speculative claims, again, on both sides of this issue. And I've really wanted to narrow this down and look at as close to a real primary source as we can. I'll explain a little more about that as we go. Here today, we've made a case against syncretism from the scriptures, and I want to apply some of those lessons to this particular holiday and look at a brief synopsis of how this criticism works in this case. It's important to begin here by talking about paganism and as a worship of nature and its gods. Times and seasons are what paganism is all about. So if you consider... let me catch up with my notes here. Okay, so go back in the old world. Imagine yourself as an ancient. You got no phone, you got no internet, you got no TV, you got no newspaper, you probably can't read. You're probably, statistically all of us, are probably some peasant. I don't care what part of the world, we were all probably peasants. So what do? You work. You work and you work and... If you live in the northern climes, you try not to die during the winter. If you live in the southern climes, you just work and work, and then you give your taxes to whoever's the boss or the chieftain or the empire and try to survive with your children, which doesn't go very well. But what do you do? What you do, generally, is you mark the seasons, you watch the stars, you pay attention to the nature. Nature is what I live or die by. And it becomes people's god because it's very visible. It's the things I can see. So it's what people make their gods out of. The changing of time, the elements of nature, these are where the pagan religions derive all of their power and ideas from. And that's particularly important when we talk about the dating of the Christmas. Seasons and celestial phenomenon, you can't, we can hardly connect with it today. Living in houses with lights and plumbing, you can I can hardly imagine how viscerally connected you feel to the changing of seasons, the changing of times, the natural world and order around you. It becomes so all-encompassing that it's how people live. It's literally how they live. And so these pagan practices are very deeply ingrained. They're very ancient. In that passing of seasons and times, in the pre-Christian era, we have some indicators of how those celebrations in the end, in the midwinter or around the equinox happened. There are some that are very well attested. Some are speculative. Some we don't have good information until centuries later. But there is some very good information to tell us things about Saturnalia, Sol Invictus, Yule, midwinter. So you have customs in the north, in Scandinavia, in northern Europe, and you have customs in the Mediterranean world. I don't know a lot about African and Asian customs. I just don't spend much time there, so I don't know those nearly as well. But Western pagan traditions, I do kind of understand, and I've studied for a long time. And all of these things have this location right around the winter equinox. The religious stories and customs around this time have to do with these seasonal changes. So imagine yourself in the ancient pagan world, and the days get shorter and shorter and shorter. And if you're in the north where winter is dangerous, that's a herald of doom. It's a bad, bad thing that winter is coming. I don't know if you've ever considered this before, but our months don't line up with the numbers they should be. December should be the 10th month, not the 12th. And on it goes. All those numerical month names, they're all off by two. And it's because in the northern part of the empire, they just went off the calendar for the winter. When you can't track the sun and the moon, you don't have any way to tell what day it is. You can go days, and maybe you could count them, but there's not a formal recognition of the calendar. So when they catch up the calendar, when there's enough modernity and travel around, they add those 2 months, January and February, to the winter that weren't normally classified. It was just winter time, and it was try to survive time. They add January and February, and it bumps everything out. That's why all our months are 2 months off. This is how desperate the situation in winter was. There's some good research about the amount of days worked in the West versus Asia or southern places, because winter is such a dangerous time. It really, really is difficult. So you work all after harvest. You have a big party because, hooray, we've got food. And then you work, delay it up, store it up, get your wood, get ready, because winter's coming. And this is the dangerous time. And then you mark the season until the days get shorter and shorter and shorter. And there's a lot of mythology connected with the sun and those days getting shorter and shorter. And the rebirth of the sun, S-U-N, happens at the equinox. Right after the winter equinox, now the days start to get longer and longer again. And hooray, we're going to live through this. And so there's a huge celebration in a lot of these cultures that happens right around this time. There's, let's move forward and look at some of them in particular. Now, these are very intrinsically connected to Western Christmas. These are Yule. Yule is a Viking or Scandinavian holiday, and the goat is a very important part of it. You'll still find in parts of Scandinavia, they'll make these huge wicker goats, and they'll burn it in a bonfire right at Christmas. And I see this stuff, and I think for American ears, you think that I'm pulling up some rare, obscure little like backwoods. These are very common ways of practicing. Not everybody practices Christmas the way that you're used to it. In Europe, these are big traditions. Like, this is a big deal where these people live. They make this huge wicker thing, they have a big party and festival, and they light it in a bonfire. It was still very common when I was a kid to send Yuletide greetings on Christmas cards. And our family cards would say Yuletide greetings. That was something that was very common in my lifetime. I don't hear it near as much anymore, but I also don't do much. I'm not around Christmas celebrations. So I don't know if that's still a common thing for Americans to say or not. But when I was a kid, it was still very common to talk about Yuletide or Yule or the Yule log. See this? This is a Yule log. This is also a Yule log. They would go out. It's fascinating how these things are connected. Again, this is just a short version. But you would go out. All the men would go out, and they would cut down a log, and they'd bring it to the house, and they would burn it for 12 days. This is the 12 days of Christmas. And then the 12th day of Christmas, you would roll the embers, the ashes of that log down the hill, and it was a way to prognosticate how fortunate your coming year would be. This was very, very important stuff to these people. And it's all just been completely consumed and subsumed with Christmas. Making of oaths was very often done at Yuletide. It was like a way to create religious significance around an oath. So it was a way to kind of like up the value of a promise that you made to someone, was to make an oath at Yuletide. And it created some sanctimony around the oath. And boars, hogs of boars were often eaten during this time at Yuletide because Adonis was a god who was represented as a stump of a tree, and he was supposedly killed by a boar, and so you would often eat a ham for Yuletide. There's all this lore. Just a quick look, we'll look at some more of that at other times, but you can see, at least from my generation, how intimately connected. And why? What does Yuletide have to do with Christmas? Why did I, in America as a Christian, send Christmas cards to all of our friends and family saying Yuletide greetings? I never thought to ask what that was. I had no idea, no clue. I just thought it meant Christmas in some weird way to say it. Why do we have a Christmas ham? What in the world's a Yule log? I don't know. It's something that has to do with Christmas. That's what most people's experience, I would say, in our country, have this kind of connection to these seasonal elements. But they're pagan. They're very clearly pagan. I hope it's clear enough to see, has nothing to do with the birth of Jesus Christ. Has nothing to do with the nativity. And is intrinsically connected to the Western experience with Christmas. This is super creepy stuff. And I'm not just trying to be scandalous here. Who's heard of Krampus before, or Krampusnacht? It's a trip. The other thing about Christmas is that our customs are pretty recent and modern. Really, late 19th, early 20th century is where Christmas really takes off in any kind of way that you and I would recognize. But Krampusnacht is indicative of some of the early ideas around the Christ Mass or the Nativity season feast. These are supposed to be representations of Nicholas, but in all of that lore in Scandinavia and in Northern Europe, Germany on up, there was a yin-yang of St. Nicholas. It was St. Nicholas was the good guy and Krampus was the bad guy. And St. Nicholas was who you got to deal with and toys if you were a good little child. And Krampus and his sticks that he would beat you with, or his bag that he would steal you with, is what you got if you were a bad child. And I put it up here. This is not some ancient thing. These are Krampus cards. They don't get sent. I don't find many modern versions of them. They're from like the 50s or so. There's lots of them, and they're fascinating to me. But this is still very much a modern thing that happens. People still have in Krampusnacht, they go out and they freak out the children, and there's kind of this like dualism that happens. There's I don't remember where it is. I think it's Switzerland.
No, it's the Netherlands.
Zwartepiet?
Yeah.
Yeah. he has original, some of the lore has a group of black slaves, and it's kind of been reduced to one person. They get on blackface. And this is kind of like their version of this like yin-yang, dark and light, white and black kind of duality that happens. Fascinating stuff. Obviously, this is not original to Christianity. This doesn't have anything to do with Jesus' nativity. It's clear. The Saturnalia is really interesting, and I want to talk about it for a couple of reasons. It's a part of the problem with trying to diagnose the syncretism of these holidays. Saturnalia is obviously for Saturn. It is the equinox festival for the Romans, and it's very well attested. There's some good literature, original literature, about people describing what Saturnalia was like. And a lot of our customs are at least appear to be very much in common with them, the evergreens, the gift giving. But the really particularly interesting thing to me about the Saturnalia is that the central thesis of the Saturnalia was the role reversal. And so there was at least a show, it probably didn't happen in any real terms, but there was a show during this festival season of Saturnalia where, like, you would have a meal where the master of the house would, all the slaves would sit around the table and the master would bring the food out. And, like, there's this big issue of role reversal in the Saturnalia at the equinox because the days are dying down and then they're coming back to life. All this stuff kind of meshes together. Now, here's where it's interesting to try to figure out how these things are connected. There's nobody in medieval Europe. So medieval Europe has a practice called several different things, called Ponce de Mes in Gaul. It's called the Lord of Misrule. It's called Abbot of Unreason. There's different names for it all throughout Europe. But what the practice is that you would have this week of festivities for the Christmas, and during that time in the town's festivities, you pick the town drunk or the town crazy person or whoever to be the Lord of Misrule for that Christmas season. In the Saturnalia, the same thing would happen with this role reversal. There would be a slave who was the Lord of the Saturnalia or whatever, and there's some attestation that that person, that Lord of Misrule, in the Saturnalia would be sacrificed in a human sacrifice, and it was a way of killing off all of the evil from the year. It seems it pops up some places and not others, but there's very clearly a connection between the European medieval use of the Lord of Misrule and the Abbot of Unreason and the Saturnalian practices of role reversal. But nobody in medieval Europe thinks they're doing a Saturnalia. They are. It's obviously the same practice. Where else does it come from? So there's an inference that they're connected, but there's no literature where you have this lineage of Saturnalia practice merging into Christmas traditions. So you kind of have to connect the dots. But you have to ask yourself at a certain point, where else is it coming from? It's the same season, it's the same custom, it's at the same time, and it's done in the same way. So at a certain point, it kind of gets like, well, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a Saturnalia. These medieval European traditions, again, it's hard for us to understand how bad this all was. Like, from a moral, religious perspective, the Christmas is not a good thing. In fact, this is why the Puritans outlaw the Christmas under Cromwell, and it's also in the United States colonies, for quite a while. Especially here in Massachusetts, the Puritans had completely outlawed, like, you were not allowed to miss work on December 25th. They had soldiers out in Britain making sure that you were at work, that the stores were open. If you had trinkets and stuff associated with the holiday, you could be thrown in jail. It was a big deal because the Christmas was very much like Carnival. It was very much a Mardi Gras kind of feel. There was these feasts, in the liturgical year, these fasts would happen, and they're pretty strict, and then they let out for the Christmas season, and everybody goes hog wild, literally. It's debauched, it's sexually immoral, it's really, really ugly stuff that happens from a moral perspective during the Christmas season. And it's a time of revelry, and all these things, it pulls in all of these Yule traditions. Here's the Lord of Misrule. Here's wassailing. This is where they would drink from a common bowl and they would bless the fruit orchards. These old depictions of Father Christmas. This, like, recompense, reward, and punishment. All this stuff gets swirled into these holidays under the Roman Catholic Church. And for this reason, I typically always call it the Christ Mass, because I want people to remember this is a Roman Catholic institution. It is a Roman Catholic standard for how the liturgical year runs. If you celebrate Christmas, the only reason you have that is because you are practicing something that was held by Roman Catholic imperialism. That's where, I mean, I'm not saying that you're doing something Roman Catholic. I'm saying that's why it's still here. That's the lineage and where it comes from. And if it weren't for that, it wouldn't exist, at least not in any way or shape that we know. Okay. It's not terribly controversial from a scholastic perspective that these practices and the pagan celebrations that are happening in the pre-Christian world influenced why we have this holiday on December 25th. That's not it's not unanimous, but it's not horribly controversial. But it's also important to say that it's not the only factor. There are other factors happening in the 4th century that caused the nativity to be settled on December 25th. For sure, these syncretic reasons are a part of it, and I think a huge part of it. Because the time that this is happening, in the 4th century, you also have a developing Christian church that has ascended in power and influence and is becoming as colonial as anything else. I mean, it's becoming so part and parcel with Romanism, and the colonial factors from that period to the place where, and even then when the nativity is marked in December 25th, it's nothing like it would become in the later medieval world. But still, there's some other factors that cause this too. There's Christological reasons. People are talking a lot about the incarnation. There's this idea in the old world that especially famous people, it comes from mythology by and large, but especially important, prominent people were supposed to have been born and died on the same day. And so because the Passion is a set narrative, they connect December 25th to either the incarnation or the Annunciation. And then the liturgical calendar builds off of that point. Kind of like, it's a little bit circular reasoning. They move back and forth over which way they're arguing from. But this idea that you're supposed to be born and die on the same day factors into the 10 months from December 25th, or the 10 months from the Annunciation brings us to December 25th. It doesn't even work in its internal logic, but there's a lot of discussion about it. There's issues of the incarnation, iconography, and what that has to do with incarnational Christianity, Christology, and the nature of Christ, and defending that he was a man. Well, if he was a man, then he had to be born, and when was he born? And all these things become significant in kind of like way secondary ways for what's happening in the church, not because of scriptural reasons. And those are also contributing factors to ending up with a celebration on December 25th of the Incarnation, which again takes many more centuries till it becomes all the crazy that we know it to be, or people have known it to be. I can't emphasize enough, though, when we consider syncretism, and especially as applies to holidays, this era of the church mixing power and all these mixed motives are creating this response where the church becomes, at least, it's doing more to colonize people than to convert them. And syncretism goes part and parcel with that agenda. If the goal of the church is to consume territories and to take over worlds, whether that's through the Roman Empire or later in Central and South America, and it's really interesting to me that the power of syncretism is much stronger in the developing world still to this day. So if you look at other practices in the liturgical year that are also very syncretic, you have, I just did a quick survey, you have All Saints Day, you have All Souls Day, you have the Feast of John Baptist, you have Candlemas, you have the Feast of St. Nicholas, you have the Nativity of Mary, the Day of the Dead, the Virgin of Guadalupe, Carnival and Lent. There's this, in Peru and Bolivia, there's this old, it's like a ritual combat that happens. It's called Tinku. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's in Bolivia and Peru. And they've mixed that with the Feast of the Holy Cross. So wherever you go, you know, you see these weird customs. And you, like, especially attached to feast days or saints' days. And you're like, what does that have to do with that? It's because these are syncretic holidays. The people of that place had these customs. And in order to be colonized by Christianity, that had to be subsumed under a Christian experience. And so the local customs become a Christian expression. Now it's for the Virgin of Guadalupe. The thing that we've always done for millennia, now we do for Virgin of Guadalupe. This combat ritual that we've done for millennia, now we do for the Feast of the Holy Cross. And this is a very common tactic for imperial colonialistic expressions of Christianity. And all of that results in giving us a nativity date of December 25th. The last point I had there, not the last point, the third to last point I had, is consumerism. I just pulled up the quick stats. About $1,000 on Christmas each year spent per household. 71% of U.S. holiday budgets are assigned to gift purchases. Holiday sales have grown year over year for over a decade. That means year by year for the last 10 years, people spend more and more money. 96% of Americans buy gifts for their families. Americans spend over $200 a year on non-gift items, lights and furnishings. Canadians spend nearly $1,000 more than Americans during the holidays. On average, men spend 10% more. It's just some trivia facts. When we go into this point in further detail, we'll talk a lot about this. The commercialization of Christmas, especially in America, is a huge factor for why it even persists to this day. The marketing ploys that were mixed into this holiday in the 20th century are really powerful dynamic forces that cause this to continue to be a cultural force and phenomenon. So much so that Christmas has survived the postmodern secularization of America. That tells you a lot. Most of your neighbors, in this place in particular, have been radically secularized in a postmodern world. Church attendance is down. Self-reported religious affections are down. In every indicator we know of, by and large, religiosity is waning year over year in America for quite a long time. But what's happening with purchases? They're up year after year. Christmas is doing quite well in a post-religious America. That's an important indicator. We can talk more about that some other time. That's the end of my slides there. But I do want to say a few more things. After a presentation like this, after a conversation like this, the most common response that I hear from people is, but that's not what it means to me. That's fine, Matthew. I get that. You're probably right. All that stuff. I mean, obviously, there's pictures and seems like a good enough case to me. I get it. But that's not what it means to me. In my home, we would sit down by the fire, and Dad would read Luke chapter 2, and we would pray together, and it was a really holy, wonderful thing. I have good memories. It's a sweet time as a family. It was really good for me. What I would say is that it was a good time for me, too. My dad read Luke chapter 2 on Christmas morning before we opened our presents and sat around the Christmas tree. It is hard to evaluate the power of nostalgia. And what I mean by that is that to this day, do any of you know what Buckeyes are? I don't mean the tree, I mean the candy. My mother makes the best Buckeyes. If you don't know what they are, they're little chocolate balls covered in, they're little peanut butter balls covered in chocolate. And my mother's a perfectionist. She does them just right. They are exquisite. And to this day, I'm 46 years old. Come wintertime, at the end of winter, I'll start to have a hankering for Buckeyes. It's ingrained in us, these experiences, especially in childhood. They're really powerful, dynamic forces at play. But that does not make them right. It does not mean that they're not syncretism wrapped up in Christianity. And And the fact that I don't have a Yule log, or I didn't, you know, go wassailing at the orchard and bless the apple trees, doesn't sanctify those practices. The problem is still the problem. The prophets have still said what the prophets have said. And God still says to you and me, I don't want you learning the way of the heathen. I do not want you inquiring after their ways. Do not use their stuff for me. And it still matters to us to be a biblical people, to base our lives and our practice on what God has revealed to us and directed to us in the scriptures. The power of nostalgia is great. The power of feelings, of fond memories is great. I've had hard conversations about this over the year. You know, I've talked to a lot of people from really hard families, from really difficult families, from abusive families, and Christmas is the only good memories they have of family. It's hard to have that conversation and say, the one good thing you remember, that's a problem. But it is. The power of nostalgia is great. The power of tradition, the normalization of these things, and the power of religious custom, it's a good thing. These are all really powerful indicators of why these are such persistent traditions among people when they have so little basis in the scriptures and in what honors God. So I'm going to end there and with a challenge for us to consider ourselves in regards to these teachings in the scriptures, and also offer that in the coming weeks and months, I'll put together, if you're interested in that more detailed analysis of where these things come from and connecting the dots, I'll put that together in the next weeks and months. Why don't we pray together, and then we'll, do we have a song? Did David leave? You got a song for us, David? All right, let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we want to give thanks to you for your goodness to us, for redeeming us and making us your own people. And more than anything, Father, we want to faithfully be your people. We want to do the things and be the things that you want us to be. And we want to avoid the shame of being uniquely Christian. We want to be willing to bear that burden because you have chosen us to be your own. You have called us out. We are known as the called out ones. And as such, Father, we want to be faithful in representing who you want us to be. I pray that you purify us as a people, not just in these ways of syncretism and holidays, but in all the ways where we fail you. When we don't know and we do it out of ignorance, I pray that you be merciful to us. I pray, Father, that you'd bless your people in our obedience to you. In Jesus' name.